Hello there, it's Jim, and my guest today is Alan Blinder, who will be very well known to most of you Bond geeks as the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve in the mid-1990s. He also served on Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisers. He is now Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University, and he's here today to discuss his new book, which is called A Monetary and Fiscal History of the United States, 1961 to 2021. Hi there, Alan.
Hello, hello. Thank you for showing the book.
Not at all. In the book, right at the very beginning, you talk about how economic theory has been dominated by fads, really. And we'll talk about some of those fads and regimes in a moment. But it got me thinking about economics itself as an academic discipline. When you were writing this book and you saw all the different fads that we've been through, even in the last 60 years, did it make you wonder, perhaps, that, you know, we're a couple of hundred years into modern capitalism, and yet it's still not, we don't know what causes booms and busts to any entirely foreseeable degree. We don't know how to treat them. And there's still lots of debate about what we do with interest rates and fiscal policy. Does it, how is it as a kind of science that it's so imprecise?
Well, it's a little bit disconcerting, but you have to realize right off the bat, I tell my introductory students this in Economics 101, is we have a huge handicap, which is we can't do controlled experiments on whole economies. We used to say we in economics can't do controlled experiments, period. But there are some in small dimensions. You can do controlled experiments. Controlled experiments on whole economies, first of all, impossible. Secondly, would raise titanic moral issues. You know, in the United States of America, you're experimenting on 330 million people or something like that. So that is never done. So what you can do is watch history and study it statistically and see what you can extract from that. And to the extent that often works tolerably well, but to the extent that something strange or unprecedented has happened, it throws you off your moorings. And the most recent example, it's not the only example, but the most recent dramatic example of that is the pandemic, which, as I often say, turned the lights out on the data. I mean, many time series that we watched sort of went kaplooey during the pandemic for fairly obvious reasons, but I'll give you an example now, productivity growth. Sometimes I get asked, what do I think about productivity growth going forward? I say, I haven't the foggiest idea, because if you look at the recent data on productivity growth in the U.S., it's like this, it's like this, it's like this, because of the pandemic, and we just don't know. And that's an important thing that the Federal Reserve would like to know.
Excellent. Well, the book starts in 1961. It's President Kennedy. It's Keynesian economics. It's what's called the new economics. And I guess one of the main features of that was it's no longer taboo to run budget deficits in the way that it was before. And it was pretty successful, at least to start with, in the 1960s. Yes. But then, you know, we saw a long sustained fall in unemployment. Then inflation starts taking off towards the end of that decade. And in the 1970s really accelerates. Do you think that Kennedy and Johnson got unlucky with Vietnam War and oil prices? Or do you think that there was a flaw in the policy to start with?
So the oil prices came later, and that was unlucky. We can come back to that. The Vietnam War, you know, we're now in the realm of politics, not economics. I don't think it was unlucky. I mean, Lyndon Johnson prosecuted that war to an extent that many people in America, I was a youngster then, I was one of the many people in America, but there were millions, thought was irresponsible and morally wrong. Those are two different things. But to the point that we're talking about now, the spending on the war piled a lot more aggregate demand on top of an economy that was probably already about at full employment because of the Kennedy-Johnson tax cuts. And straight Keynes says that's a recipe for inflation. So there was nothing contradictory to Keynesian economics about the outcome. In fact, I document in the book, it was Johnson's Keynesian advisors like Walter Heller and Art Oaken clamoring, please raise taxes to pay for the war. And Johnson wouldn't do that. So that was not a failing of Keynesian economics. But to your question, it got misinterpreted by many people as a failure of Keynesian economics. And Keynesian economics got unfairly branded as inherently inflationary, which it isn't. It's two-sided, really.
Well, I guess that leads on to the next question, because while this was going on, you had people like Milton Friedman. And in the book, you almost suggest that the monetarists were back-testing any relationships they could find with money supply, growth, yes, and consumer spending to try and find these relationships. So it ended up in the 1970s with monetarists towards the end of it. The Fed Act was amended to include money supply and credit creation in there. But do you believe then that there wasn't much to it other than data mining, really, the whole monetarist wave that, yeah, that took over the popular, well, became the fad of choice for right-wing politicians?
It's a slight exaggeration what you just said, but more true than untrue in my view. There was a lot of that backcasting. I witnessed some of it. I could actually see in some academic sessions. In those days, we often used charts with acetates. You remember those?
I do.
Youngsters don't have the slightest idea what I'm talking about. But you could easily slide them left or slide them right and try to find a correlation. There was some of that. But that said, the correlation between money growth and, say, GDP growth or inflation, either, was much stronger in the 50s and 60s and started to die slowly at first and then rapidly in the 70s and into the 80s. And so much so, and the main cause was financial innovation, made it impossible for one central bank after another, including the Fed, but not limited to the Fed, to even define the money supply. Like, what do we mean? What kind of accounts and other instruments are in the money supply? What are out of the money supply? That's kind of a primitive question before you come to testing whether the money supply is a big deal in determining economic activity. You have to define the object that you're talking about. That became almost impossible in the 70s. There's a famous quotation from the, which I repeat in the book. I've repeated it many times, from the then governor of the Bank of Canada, who said, we didn't abandon the M's, they abandoned us. And that's basically what happened all over the world.
Okay, and then at the start of the 80s, obviously, monetarism is still mainly driving politicians around the world. But you've got Paul Volcker, who comes in to the Fed. You describe as the Babe Ruth of central banking. And I think most people in the bond market would say he's the man who made fixed income investable again, in a way, having been uninvestable because of the high inflation rates. To what extent do you regard him as a legend or a game changer amongst central bankers, you know, perhaps the most important of all?
Absolutely a game changer. Game changer is the right metaphor to use. There was a pervasive view in America and also in other countries, but it was very strong here, that it was close to hopeless to get inflation down from the 8-10% level, where, you know, depending on the time that you looked at it, down to where it should be. And we weren't so specific then about where it should be, but certainly a lot lower, maybe 3%, maybe 2%, maybe 4%, but a lot lower than it was. And there was a lot of despair and some estimates of just horrific costs to get that done. Now, in the event, the costs were high, but not as high as some of the hysterical analyses that were done before Paul Volcker. But I bring that up because that's the atmosphere in which Volcker became chairman of the Fed. And he looked at that and said some combination of, and you'd have to get inside his head, he's not with us anymore, to know the combination. Some combination of, I don't believe it and I don't care. I'm not sure what the weights were on it, but he was determined to get inflation down and really didn't believe it would be that costly. It was costly, but not as costly as some of the hysterical estimates had said. And that just took guts and an iron will. a little sidelight. It was at that juncture in time that the Federal Reserve got security guards, armed security guards. Volcker and others were getting death threats, which had to happen. Nowadays in America, everybody gets death threats. So, you know, if you're not getting a death threat, there's something wrong with you. That's a sad commentary on our country. But in those days, it was not the norm at all.
Wow. Well, let's move on to the Clinton years when you were an advisor. To what extent were the bond vigilantes real? And how do you feel about the kind of hypocrisy that we see from, I guess, the Republican Party, who actually were expanding budget deficits? Under Reagan, they went up from 2.5% to 6%. And yet under the Clinton regime, you kind of weren't allowed to use budget deficit financing. Yep. Was that a real thing in your mind?
Oh, very real. I mean, we talked about the bond market constantly at a few junctures, exasperating President Clinton, who said, you know, are we at the mercy of a bunch of bleep bleep bond traders? I can't repeat that on air. And some of his advisors, I was just one of them, said, well, sort of we are, that what we're doing here is, making a bet that if we can pass a credible program of deficit reduction, the bond market will start smiling on us instead of frowning at us. And what that will mean concretely is bond rates will fall, and that will restore some of the demand that we're taking out of the economy by our policies. So the bond market was crucial to the thinking. You may remember the first head of the National Economic Council, who then became Secretary of Treasury, was Bob Rubin, who had come out of Goldman Sachs, a bond trader, basically. So, you know, we were talking and thinking about the bond market vigilantes a lot.
Cool. Well, let's go to the global financial crisis. Ben Bernanke, he referred to Friedman and Schwartz and talked about the Great Depression and basically put his hand up and said, you're right, we, the Federal Reserve, we did it. We're very sorry, but thanks to you, we won't do it again. And then in comes QE and an expansion of the money supply, effective money printing. What's your thinking about that fad? It never struck me that Bernanke felt like an arch monetarist.
No, but by no means. But an admirer of Milton.
What's he getting at?
But an admirer of Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, and agreeing with them on their basic critique of the Fed. I want to put a footnote to that in a second. But on their basic critique that the Fed let the money supply shrink in the early 30s, and that made things much worse than they should have been. So he believed that. I believe that. I think that's now part of the conventional common wisdom and correct. The footnote is that young Ben Bernanke, as a PhD student at MIT, had written a very important paper that later led to his Nobel Prize just recently, pointing out that it wasn't just money, it was the collapse of the credit granting mechanism that happened in the 1930s that accounted not so much for the depth of the Great Depression, but the difficulty of climbing out. So you had to restore the credit granting mechanisms to climb out, and that was not done very expeditiously or very well. So that's, ironically, that's kind of a non-monetarist explanation of the same phenomenon, but it doesn't take away from the notion that on the downswing, when the economy was going down from 1929, 30, 31, 32, the Fed was not boosting the money supply as it should have, but was allowing it to shrink. And if that makes you a monetarist, I'm a monetarist. Bernanke's a monetarist. We're all monetarists now, if that's the definition. I don't think it is.
Okay, well, let's talk about now. And going into 2023, it feels like there was a chance we were going to get a modern money theory fad a couple of years ago. That seems to have faded away. I'm not quite sure how you would describe what policymakers are doing now. I guess what's quite unusual is that it feels like we've got central banks going in one direction and fiscal policy going in the other direction for the first time in quite a long time. What would you say, how do you describe the regime we're in now, and what kind of future regimes could you envisage?
So I would describe the regime right now is that basically, now this is not true of every country, the 200-something countries on Earth, certainly true of the United States, and that's true of the UK, that the fiscal authorities have turned over the steering wheel to the monetary authorities. And the reason they've done that is the problem of the day is not high unemployment or economic weakness, but very high inflation. And if you're at least a little bit intelligent about economic policy, you realize that's the central bank doing. You know, the fiscal authorities can nibble around the edges. We just passed in the United States something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which will have a little effect on inflation years from now and reduce it. So, I mean, hence, but that was a marketing name. The real inflation reduction is being done at the Federal Reserve. And what you had recently in the British case was a kind of a clash. I guess it was mostly a verbal clash because it all ended too fast for anything to happen, between the fiscal authorities looking expansionary and the monetary authorities looking contractionary to try to fight inflation. So a little bit reminiscent of what happened with Reagan and Volcker in the U.S. several decades ago. But it was nipped in the bud, it seems, if I may coin a phrase, by the bond market vigilantes that didn't like that one little bit. That's not happening in the United States. We had our gigantic fiscal expansion in 20 and 21. And now if you look at the latest numbers, this is kind of inevitable as you come off a peak. The fiscal thrust is negative on spending, not positive. And so is the monetary thrust.
Fantastic. I'm going to give a copy of this book to anyone who starts working in the bond market with me. I think it's a fantastic piece of history. Thanks very much for A, writing it, and B, coming on to talk about it today. So, Alan Blinder, A Monetary and Fiscal History of the United States, 1961 to 2021. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Jim, for the conversation. Appreciate it.